Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in Science Fiction, part of the New Books Network of Podcasts. I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe, and before I introduce today's guest, I want to encourage everyone who enjoys this show to please leave a quick review about us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Reviews help others find us. I'm calling today's episode, "The Singularity Happened and All I Got Was This Lousy iPhone 7." With me today is Douglas Lane to talk about his new book, Bash Bash Revolution, which came out in March. He's also the author of After the Saucers Landed, which was nominated for the Philip K. Dick Award in 2016, and he's the publisher of Zero Books, which specializes in books about philosophy and political theory, and he also hosts the Zero Books podcast. He's on the line now from his studio in Portland, Oregon. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back on. My studio has my bed in it, so it's my bedroom studio, but yes.
You have a bed. I have a cat litter box.
It's very glamorous, the life of a podcaster.
It sure is. The book cover says Bash Bash Revolution is, quote, a compelling coming-of-age post-singularity novel. I hear the term singularity a lot, and I think I have an intellectual grasp on the definition. But it wasn't until I read your book that I got a really visceral sense of what it means, or what you think it means. And I have to say, the vision you present is pretty terrifying. Could you explain the term singularity and how it plays out in your book?
Well, I can explain the concept of the singularity, and then I can explain how it plays out in my book, which are, I think, two different things, really. The Ray Kurzweil understanding of the singularity is that there will be a point where computer technology has advanced so far, the computing power has advanced so far that it will start to, well, we'll get an artificial intelligence and the programs will start to program themselves. And a lot of our problems that seem insurmountable now will just be solved instantaneously by this incredibly intelligent machine. All sorts of visions arise, one of which might be just the total annihilation of humanity by AIs and robots. Another might be that, we all get to live forever as the robots and AIs, overcome aging and help us launch into space. Or maybe we'd upload our consciousness onto the internet and get to live forever that way. It's both a dystopian and a utopian vision. It's really all bets are off when it comes to what will happen when our technology becomes sentient and changes the world for us. But that's how I think of the singularity. And my vision is one where that happens, but it's taken from the point of view of a teenage gamer who's sort of moping about during his senior year and right after of high school. And as he's watching the singularity kind of take hold, and complaining about it on Facebook.
Why did you want to tell a story about the singularity?
Well, I didn't actually originally want to tell the story about the singularity. I wanted to tell a story. Well, I had two aims. One was I wanted to tell a story in which a middle-aged father could beat his son at Super Smash Brothers Melee. And because I have a now 21-year-old son who for years was able to always beat me at Super Smash Brothers Melee. And I was so frustrated, I decided to write a novel where the father gets to win.
Because you never actually won in real life, so you decided to become victorious in fiction?
That's right. It was a wish fulfillment move on my part. It's a little bit of wish fulfillment fantasy writing there. The other more serious reason I ended up writing about the singularity is because I wanted to. I'm kind of a wannabe Marxist, and I've read Capital Volume 1, and I've been thinking about what it would take to break from capitalist production and the capitalist economic, political, social system. And I was trying to imagine what could come along that could conceivably really replace capitalist production. And I ended up having to reach into the science fiction fantasy world for the singularity to do it. But I also borrowed from critics of capitalism to do it. I borrowed from specifically from Guy Debord, who wrote The Society of the Spectacle back in, I think it was 1967, where he proposed that we had already broken with capitalist commodity production in terms of the way Marx conceived it, where you produce useful commodities and the value in those commodities dictates and directs society and what's produced in society. And said he proposed that images had replaced commodities, or the ultimate commodity was an image, and that we were living not inside what we thought of as a capitalist system, but instead in a society of the spectacle. So I thought, well, what if you really took that to heart and believed it? What would that look like to live inside of a spectacle, inside of basically where your life is directed by images and entertainment and media? And this concept of the singularity and being absorbed into virtual reality and video games and augmented reality video games was what I came up with, is what the society of the spectacle would really be. And so, yeah, there's a lot of things going on there, but that's why I ended up writing this book.
In a recent essay in the Los Angeles Review of Books, you quote another philosopher, Slavoj Zizek, to make the point that your book isn't really about virtual reality, but augmented reality, which you just mentioned just now. And if I understand your point, you're saying that the way we see the world is already colored by our fantasies, whether it's our political fantasies or cultural myths, so that this AI that's in the book, which goes by the name Bucky, what Bucky is doing differently is that instead of the world being divided by left and right and pro and anti-Trump, he's helping us all get along by essentially giving us the equivalent of Google glasses and augmented reality video games.
Yeah. I mean, the fantasy that I think that he's replacing is the fantasy that labor time should produce value in and of itself, and that we should let the world be dictated by this system of capitalist production. But I mean, I don't go into that in any real detail in the book. That's sort of way back in the background. So I think it is fair to say that he's replacing everyday life and the sorts of stories and ideologies and narratives that we, I guess that's the same as stories, that we tell ourselves in order to get through the day, in order to have the kinds of relationships that we have. He's replacing that with, at first anyway, mostly retro video games, so that now instead of worrying about, say, getting a girlfriend, which is what Matthew, the main character in the book, is worried about, you'll be worried about, you know, winning at Mario Kart, but in real life, or getting through the obstacle course in a round of Paperboy, which would be one of those retro games But you, because Bucky is an AI, and because he's so good at programming and creating new technology, the Google glasses that you wear don't just augment your eyes, but kind of connect through sound actually to your central nervous system and really take over your consciousness, so that now you feel fully immersed in this new fantasy and feel like your identity can really merge with whatever character you're taking on, whether it's Sonic the Hedgehog or Pac-Man or some character in a, like World of Warcraft or something like that.
In Bash Bash Revolution, it's the teenager, Matthew Munson's father, who invented Bucky for a certain purpose, presumably, I think, to help improve humanity. But is it inherent in this system where and when the singularity is achieved, the artificial intelligence becomes smarter than its inventor and can basically do what it wants? So it's sort of a gamble. Is it gonna be a benevolent intelligence and lead us to a better place, or is it going to be malevolent or conclude that the better place for us is extermination, since we haven't been always on our best behavior as human beings?
I don't think Bucky is planning on exterminating humanity. As to whether or not he's benevolent or malevolent, you know, I think it depends on how much you enjoy becoming a frog in real life and playing Frogger for days or weeks or months at a time. The way I wrote this novel is really from the point of view of Matthew, who doesn't want to be absorbed into this new, what it's called, the GameCube economy, and who's trying to hold on to a more traditional, more mundane kind of life. And once I worked through his story, the larger story of what's going to happen to all of humanity was sort of left open. I could imagine if I was going to try to write a sequel to this, that the danger would be that it would be something like The Matrix, you know, where there's a renegade group of rebels. But I would probably want to explore how human beings try to develop a relationship with Bucky and try to reprogram Bucky rather than try to escape from him, would be what I would do, rather than the Matrix approach where you're trying to break into reality. It'd be more like, we know we're part of a programmed reality. We know that Bucky is dictating our lives, but we also can program. We're all programmers, or some of us are, and all of us could be. And maybe we can develop a system where we at least have a relationship with Bucky and can move him rather than simply be moved around by him.
Matthew seems to have a pretty good strategy, at least in the beginning, for avoiding being seduced by Bucky and the GameCube economy. You know, while everyone else is wearing the augmented reality goggles and jumping around in these green chroma key suits so they can live out their, you know, Bucky-guided fantasies, Matthew is simply not listening to Bucky. He's not putting in the earbuds, and he's not playing these games.
Yeah.
That's not something he apparently can do forever, but do you think if and when the singularity comes that people can save themselves by, you know, living off the grid, unplugging, or is it by definition, would that be impossible because the singularity really is all-encompassing, and the artificial intelligence, because it's so smart, will find a way to capture or eliminate anyone who doesn't play along?
I'm thinking about that. I think that if you are dealing with an AI like Bucky, that there might be pockets of people who would be allowed to live off the grid for a while. I mean, the thing about Matthew is he's really close to the source here. He's the son of the inventor. So Bucky is maybe irrationally interested in making sure that he's part of the system, because he was so instrumental in getting everything set up to begin with in reality. But I don't know. I think that there's, it really depends on what the AI's aims are. I mean, there's some visions of the singularity where what happens is an AI comes along, but it's programmed to make, let's say, make paper clips. Like that's original programming for the AI, that so like a paper clip manufacturing program becomes sentient, but it holds on to its original goal. And so it just transforms everything on Earth into paper clips. And I imagine a machine like that would be impossible to escape. So I guess it really depends on what kind of AI we end up with and what its original programming is like, possibly.
Your book, like a number of books I've been reading lately, is super current. I mean, the references, it's as if you finished the book 6 months ago or something, because Trump is in it and Jeff Sessions is in it, and the crisis around tweeting, or the crises that are precipitated by tweets, is in it. So that at times I was wondering which was the bigger crisis. Was it the technology itself becoming rapidly so smart, or was it just simply Trump becoming president? And somehow they felt linked, you know, maybe because Trump is arguably a byproduct of technology run amok, you know, given the internet and social media gone wild.
Well, you know, it's tough to say when you read the book whether or not Bucky and the AI created Trump or not. I think that's ambiguous. I mean, it certainly, the technology, the way the digital technology has taken over already the society, just in from a current, you know, kind of reality perspective, that has played a role. But whether or not the AI is responsible, I think, is an open question. But the way I conceived of the book while I was telling the story was that it was sort of a race between Trump's stupidity and the AI's ability to transform the society, to make Trump irrelevant. That was that was certainly how Jeff, Matthew's father, the original programmer of Bucky, conceived of it. Is that, you know, his task was to help the AI save us from ourselves and save us from Trump. And it definitely, the book is in a way a post-Trump book. I started it before Trump was elected, but once he was elected, it became obvious I had to include him in my vision of the apocalypse. Because one of the things that is going on in the book is that the threat of nuclear war is hanging over everyone's head as the novel goes along. I mean, the book starts with Matthew talking about how he dropped out of high school because he just doesn't see himself having any real future. And it's not because of himself, but the world that he's in. So, like, he's a straight-A honor roll student, and he just decides halfway through, or a little more than halfway through his senior year, to drop out because why bother to pretend that he's got a future when he doesn't think he does. And that sentiment is sort of spread throughout the book. The only one who doesn't feel that way, I think, is Jeffrey Munson, his dad, who's fully invested in the technological singularity and the techno solution to our political and social problems.
In the Wikipedia entry on the singularity, there is a reference to a number of polls, I guess, that were conducted a few years ago that said the median estimate among experts for when the actual singularity would arrive was somewhere around in between the years 2040 to 2050. Mm-hmm. But as we've just discussed, you've chosen to set the story in the here and now.
Right.
Is that for fun, as a warning, or because you think it really could be just around the corner?
I don't really believe that the singularity is coming. So I feel free to use the singularity concept however I want. I'm not really trying to predict the singularity. I don't know if artificial intelligence is possible or what that would really mean in reality. I just know what the science fiction ideas are, what Ray Kurzweil says and some of these transhumanists think. But I didn't feel in any way obliged to stick by the dogma about timelines. And I think that they keep putting it forward into the future, but I don't know.
I remember when cell phones first came out, I would look down the street and I would be amazed if I could see, like, wow, there's actually two people on the block talking on their phones. That is so weird. And then the next year it would be seven people on the same block talking on their phones. And now I would say at least half the people walking down a crowded street are looking at their phones as they're walking. And on the subway train, 60 or 70% of the people are playing games and reading on their phones and listening to music on their phones. And I thought, wow, if Bucky were out there somewhere, he could find a way. I say he, could be she, could be they, you know, it could find a way to control insidiously everything that we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, and so, like, there's two different questions about this. Like, will we be able to develop an AI and will the singularity happen is one question. The other is, will we be in a system of control in which our technology is fully integrated into our lives and we're directed by it? And I think that's a different question, because we don't need an AI or some super computer intelligence to do that second thing. I mean, I think I read a news article or an essay not so long ago about how they had developed sensors that could read people's thoughts and then have the thoughts move objects, like, you know, like it would be a radio transmission from the device on your head that would then make a mechanical hand move or something like that. And the idea was that it would help paraplegics or other people who had severe disabilities have more mobility and give them the power of well, using their hands or using mechanical hands. But if you can have it work so that your brain moves a machine, you can also possibly send signals to the brain and have those signals change the brain so that those signals move you. I think they've done studies with rats along those lines, like remote control rats. And so that possibility, I think, could happen any day. I mean, if someone figured out a way to do that, to develop the technology where a sound could tap right into your brain and rearrange your neurons or the signaling or something, that's conceivably a, you know, not too far off dystopian scenario that you know, society of control could be right around the corner if it's not already here.
So you wouldn't need fake news anymore to manipulate people. You would just push a button and they would vote the way you wanted them to.
Yeah, or say what you wanted them to say, or walk where you wanted them to walk. And they would think that it was coming from themselves because it would be their own brains that were, you know, creating the signal to move their body. They would not feel as though they were being manipulated.
So as someone who publishes philosophy and is obviously very well read in philosophy and also writes science fiction, do you think science fiction is a natural medium for expressing and exploring philosophy?
I do, in so much as fiction is, if fiction can be a way to do that, and that's a debatable idea, but if I were to pick a genre to set up thought experiments, philosophical thought experiments in, it would definitely be science fiction or fantasy, I guess. And it happens all the time. I mean, you know, I have philosophical questions around identity and pretty serious ones have shown up on Star Trek, for instance. Yeah, The Matrix is a philosophical movie with a philosophical problem in it. So, yeah, I do think that it's a natural fit. What do you think?
Well, I'm the interviewer. I don't have to answer questions like that.
I know, but I'm so used to having my own podcast. Like, oh, I'm just answering one question after the other. I want to ask him questions now.
Well, I would think so, too. Although what was interesting and the reason I thought of that question was because people, you know, we think, when people think of science fiction, they think of maybe science first, and they think of technology and what's going to be the next invention and what's the implication of that invention on society. And then they may think next about changes in society and in politics and, you know, what if this particular planet was governed in this way, or what if it was ruled by aliens with this kind of anatomy that led to this kind of social structure and culture. But I rarely hear people use the word philosophy, even as you say, those ideas are in fact explored. And I thought someone like yourself who is, you know, writes about philosophy and reads about it and publishes it might have a different take. Maybe you look at science fiction first as an opportunity to explore philosophy, and that technology is really a byproduct of that.
I do think of, well, when I write science fiction, I mean, I don't know about inventing science, inventing technology is that's first philosophy and then technology. But when I write science fiction, I certainly always start with philosophical questions or some sort of big question that's bothering me. But I don't know if I'm unique in that way or not. And I had an experience when I was in college years ago where I had two interesting experiences along that sort of asked the same question. I was in a creative writing class and I was in a philosophy class. And in both of them, I tried to submit in both of them, I submitted what I thought of as fiction, but in one, there was a lot of philosophy in my fiction, and the other, there was a lot of fiction in my philosophy. Right? So these papers came in where I was telling stories, but I was also asking philosophical questions. I'm not sure that they were very good. It was a long time ago. But in both cases, my professors were a little put off by that move. And I would say that the literature or creative writing professor was more irritated than the philosophy professor. Like the philosophy professor said, you did a good job with this. The problem with writing short stories or fiction in order to explore philosophical ideas is that sometimes narratives can paper over problems in an argument, and a more dry, methodical, systematic approach to exploring questions generally is a better approach for philosophy because you lay out the arguments very, very clearly, and you don't get to use any rhetorical tricks or sleight of hand. But in this case, I'm going to give you a good grade anyway, and I like the paper. The creative writing professor just thought I was doing the wrong thing. I was not exploring. Well, first of all, it was a science fiction kind of story in a creative writing department in the 90s. He was put off by that. But also, he just said, literature is not about exploring ideas or philosophical ideas. Literature is about characters and the psychology of the characters and exploring the human condition. And you know what? I probably forgotten his argument somewhat because I was so put off by it. But I do just really remember that it's controversial to the question of whether or not philosophy and argumentation and polemical approaches really fit into fiction or not is a controversial question. So that might be why I wanted to turn around and ask you. I just wanted your validation. I can do that, right? I'm allowed. Anyway.
Well, I think anyone would say if it's a good story, you can put anything in it. You know, if you have, right. I mean, maybe the professor was saying, you know, but maybe not that if you have good character, good plot, everything's tight, everything serves a purpose. I mean, I think you could probably say anything probably and explore any idea.
Yeah, I think so.
Or the person was an idiot.
I won't get stuck there. I think it's really, I think there's a philosophical question about what is the purpose of literature and what is the distinction between philosophy and literature, which I haven't resolved completely, but just act as though I have and write what I want to write anyway.
If you could install in today's White House a Secretary of Philosophy, and you could be that philosopher, what would you tell our current president? What is he missing? What philosophical questions would you have him contemplate?
Oh, gosh.
That's completely out of left field, but...
I know. It's fine. It's just... The first thing that comes to mind is that, you know, you're asking cliche pearls before swine. I mean, I just don't know if it would be of any use to ask him to contemplate anything. But I guess what I would want to get Trump to contemplate is the problem of the basic problem of epistemology. I would want him to consider how difficult it is to be certain of ideas how hard it is to come to the truth.
He would say it's not hard at all. The truth is self-evident.
Right. And I would want him to consider a bunch of different philosophers who show how difficult, how that's wrong, how what we think is self-evident is almost always just a matter of habit of mind or ideology or traditions that have been indoctrinated into us, but that seem natural but aren't. I that's what I'd want him to do. Basically, I'd want to try to get him to start thinking and questioning his presuppositions.
And what's your relationship to technology? Your book is about a certain aspect of technology. And I'll note for listeners that as a writer and a publisher, you've embraced podcasting and you've been using YouTube also to promote ideas in the books you publish. So you're clearly not anti-technology, but maybe you're a little ambivalent about certain aspects of it.
Oh, well, I am absolutely, I mean, if the singularity came, I would be in one of those green Lycra suits in a heartbeat. I mean, I am totally, I'm way too online. I have Facebook and Twitter. I have Snapchat. I have a podcast and YouTube. I sit at my computer most days way too long. When I don't have my computer on and I'm not sitting at home at my kitchen table, which is where I do a lot of work now, or here in my big studio or honestly my bedroom, then I'm out and about with my phone in my pocket and all too often in my hand. So, I am just as much of a plugged-in zombie as anyone. But I'm ambivalent about it, and I'm also ambivalent about my ambivalence. I mean, the weird thing here with this book was I was trying to conceive of a socialist utopia when I started the book, and I ended up writing about humanity being absorbed by an AI. So, I'm not exactly sure where I stand in relationship to technology. Or how full-throatedly I can, espouse some Luddite position. But I'm certainly ambivalent about it.
Has it surprised you that Bash Bash Revolution has been taken by some to be a young adult novel?
I didn't set out to write a young adult novel, although when I, think about it, it does have a teenage protagonist, and it is about gamers and video game culture. So, it will be of interest, I hope, to a lot of teenagers and people who are gamers. I want people to understand, I guess, who are listening, that for the first time in my writing career, the book is fairly accessible. I mean, my other books have been even more deeply kind of mired in philosophical questions, and this one has a lot of them, but they're approached more lightly, I think. So, but yeah, I was a little surprised, and the extent to which it has been tagged by as a young adult novel has meant that, sometimes it ends up in odd places. Like, and when I went to the University of Oregon to visit my kids, I went to the Duck Store, which was it's the university's bookstore, and I found my book there, but it was in the kids' corner next to like The Wrinkle in Time and right across from some picture books. So I'm not sure. I mean, the characters in my book smoke pot and contemplate the end of the world. So I'm not exactly sure if that's where it fit, but maybe so. Young adult novels have come a long way.
Yeah, a lot of young adults smoke pot and contemplate the end of the world.
That's true.
And it's been compared in some reviews maybe as a counterpoint to Ready Player One.
I'm happy with that because maybe it will help get the book Bash Revolution a little more attention, because Ready Player One has been made into a major movie and it's a very successful book. I hadn't read Ready Player One when I wrote the book, but I was aware of it. So, I mean, it was sort of an influence on the book, just in the sense that it was in the zeitgeist, you know, it was out there. But I'm not unhappy with the comparison. There are a lot of things that are similar about the two books, like the retro quality is sort of in both. Like I, because of my age, probably more than anything, turned to sort of old school video games for a lot of the references in my book. Although, you know, today's teenage gamers sort of are nostalgic for that, those games, just like I am, weirdly. So yeah, I think it's an interesting comparison. I think the video game culture is more important than maybe people think. And I do think that the books are different in the way that I wrote about in the LA Review of Books. But because my book is different and almost in opposition to Ready Player One in some ways, it does mean that there's a lot of commonality between the two stories.
Well, what's the main point of opposition for people who aren't going to read your essay in the Los Angeles Review of Books?
Well, the main point of opposition would be that Ready Player One imagines society as it is now, only with virtual reality dominating it, whereas my book imagines how virtual reality could supplant or replace the current society. That I have actually more faith in the ability for technology, at least in this book, more faith in the ability of technology to truly transform society rather than be some sort of supplement to the capitalist system.
Great. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Douglas Lane, author of Bash Bash Revolution, which came out a couple months ago from Nightshade Books. For more author interviews, check out newbooksnetwork.com and click on the Science Fiction show link, or subscribe to the New Books and Science Fiction podcast on your favorite podcasting app. Our theme music is by Michael Aaron of quivernyc.com. The editor-in-chief of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe, and the editor is Leanne Wilson. Don't forget to leave a review if you've liked today's show. I'm Rob Wolf. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Wolf Books. Thank you so much for listening to today's show.